For the same reason, an arbitrary elimination of the other party from our activity is also to refuse oneself. Disinterestedness that excludes a part of ourselves or our lives from the common goal of marriage is a refusal to work together and lays the foundation for serious divergences in our lives. The effective collaboration of married couples in their proper activities is common today. Those who have practiced it know what a bond of unity it can be, but to be unifying and truly fruitful, it must be born of circumstances that imply mutual self-giving. There is no rule more common or more certain than the harmonization in the home of the activities of husband and wife. Union of bodies. This union reveals the essential characteristics of all unity. Because it rests upon an indisputable state of things, we can refer to it to understand the value, in any union, of complementary diversity, of the leadership of the man over the woman, of the joyful and living submission of the woman in whom passivity would be an absence of life. Passivity would be a submission deceptive to the husband and without any positive influence on the profound harmony of their personalities. The reality of the marriage act is concrete evidence of this. Let us note also that the child, the concrete and perfect fruit of this common ideal, guarantees still further benefits. Marriage then appears to us as the most human union in the world, the only union that is fully so, because in it no element is foreign to the other. Here, moreover, are established the closest possible bonds between domains reputed to be foreign or even opposed to each other. Far from conflicting, they reinforce one another mutually. Granted the absence of sin, which falsifies everything, this reinforcement goes beyond any expression we can give of it. Children of God have always known and experienced that the union of their bodies can be a powerful aid to the union of their hearts and souls. Contrary to certain negative suspicions in regard to the nobility of this act, married couples must place every confidence in it. It brings with it abundant graces of union. Here they renew the enthusiasm of their yes. Respect for this implies, among other things, for the husband as well as the wife, a desire to please the other on the plane of physical attraction by a concern for bodily hygiene. This preoccupation is not a purposeless luxury, but concurs in the common realization of the masterpiece that is a complete union in love of one's whole being with that of another. Union of characters. Upon this depends the harmony, joy and peace of the home. For characters are also complementary. There are evident psychological differences between man and woman. There are, in addition, differences that issue from diverse educations and backgrounds. It is important to be fully cognizant of these differences. For marital harmony is realized out of the raw materials of divergent notes of character. We should bear in mind that it is never a question of becoming identical, it is rather a question of accord. Does this include defects of character as well? Certainly. In the work of harmonizing our marriage, we cannot forget that our characters are sinful and the common accord of our lives must take into account our contrarieties and imperfections. To love someone is to love that person as he is and not as we would like him to be. We are under no obligation to love his faults, but we must love him enough that his faults will not set up enmity between us. The common unity of our marriage will then, far from constituting an amorous cultivation of reciprocal faults, enable us to know and diminish them. This can be done through a deep and profound collaboration which we will discuss in more detail apropos of the union of souls. It seems that we sense in this connection the intervention of paternal and maternal love, so strong in both man and woman that the husband's paternity in relation to his wife, and conversely, the woman's maternity in relation to the husband must be considered profoundly allied to their conjugal love. But these mutual faults, even though they diminish, will not always be overcome immediately. Due to the psychological differences between man and woman, even defects of character can frequently become the basis of harmony. One efficacious means of keeping peace in the home is to cultivate the antidote of the other's faults, calmness and patience. For example, if the other conspicuously lacks these virtues. This practice will help the other partner acquire what he does not have. The educative influence of daily example needs no demonstration, and contribute to the maintenance of the equilibrium in a home. Union of hearts. Numerous nuances differentiate the love of a man from that of a woman. Neither can expect to be loved as he or she loves. Man wants to protect, to lead the woman he loves. He reveals himself more the conqueror in love than the receiver, yet he has an immense need of woman. Woman offers herself to the man she loves. She needs, above all, to be necessary and submissive to him. To be no longer necessary, is a kind of death. Her love restores and appeases man. She wants to give and to give herself, she wants to be received by man that her love might be a food to him. These are perhaps the general and habitual differences, visibly complementary, between their two manners of loving. There are certain other differences which lead to the false belief that one loves less than the other. It is a belief that leads one to suffer from what appears a lack of love, while the other suspects a kind of deception, a reproach which he cannot understand and which appears to him unjust. We must at all costs abstain from this secret censure which separates hearts. Frequently this subtle separation takes place without the knowledge of one party until the day he realizes with great sorrow that the other has strayed far from their common ideal and permanently destroyed the unity of their marriage. Perfection here consists in refraining from all reproaches. If this proves impossible, if every effort to reason away a suspected deception fails, then the only solution is total frankness with each other. It is always better to express our thoughts in these matters as soon as possible. Such openness is relatively easy provided it is done without bitterness or egoism or a spirit of revendication, but with love, in view of a greater love. Happiness contributes greatly to the unity of marriage. So too, in a still deeper sense, does suffering. A few years of marriage is sufficient to teach us to what point the suffering lived by two people cements their union and how, by a return to grace, this union helps them bear their suffering and offer it to God. Two weaknesses then become an astonishing strength. It is especially in the common love of children that the union of hearts is established, just as it is especially in the maturity of later years that it will reach completion. Union of tastes and sensibilities. This union invites us to exchanges which are, in the home, sources of multiple joys. The tastes of one are added to those of another to complete them. These are so many new ways of seeing, feeling and understanding persons and things that married couples can communicate to each other. They can do this easily, for nothing is more communicable or even more communicative than tastes or differences of taste, than impressions and sentiments, understood in the sense that we say certain people, more than others, have a taste for beauty. Must we again mention the serious incomprehensions encountered here? Our guiding principle should be not to insist upon sharing our personal sentiments with the other, but rather to seek out what we enjoy together. The young Beethoven used to say, when he began to compose, "I'm looking for notes that like each other." We must always try to pick out these notes with a light finger and, when they are struck, they frequently call forth others. Innumerable fields of action are offered to the common sharing of tastes and sensibilities. The choice of friends and their welcome in the home seems to be of this order: a common joy in meeting enriching personalities, in kind attention to others, in a constant concern to make them feel welcome, in the desire to understand them, to help them and to open oneself to whatever they can bring to our home. In this manner we soon feel that it is the heart of the home that is attractive to others, that it is our common welcome much more than the individual affection shown by either the husband or wife. To share our past also responds to an ardent desire of love. It is to relive for the other the atmosphere of our childhood, the people we loved then, and draw forth a new evocation of the other's past. Actually, the past then becomes the present, not only in our memories, but also in the way we act, in our tastes and in our personalities. It is a part of ourselves to which the other has a right. For henceforward our lives are one, in their origins as well as in their development. Union of wills. Marriage is two strengths, two wills joined in the service of each other, the service of their community, the service of their neighbor and the service of God. This ideal can be achieved much better if husband and wife are united and not isolated, if they are in agreement on the essential points and then, in the measure of the grace that is given to them and depending upon circumstances, on the secondary ends, and if they are capable of harmonizing their means to this common end. The essential accord here resides in a common objective. The end we pursue makes us what we are. We become the person of our objective. Ideally, man's will, clear-cut and enterprising, seems to be that of a leader who pursues his objective logically, overcomes all obstacles in the way and dominates them one by one. Woman's will, marked by an intuitive and tenacious sense of direction, what might be called sweet stubbornness, obeys the directives which her heart dictates. The genius of her will is expressed in an intuition of the best tactics to adopt towards herself and others, whether it be a question of personal development, of love, of running the home or the education of the children. Harmony, if it were always thus, would be simple to realize. Practically speaking, however, one of the couple is almost always more energetic than the other. Whence the danger of one's absorbing the other. If one partner has a dominating will, he should guard against crushing the other's personality, an unfortunate phenomenon in many a home. On the other hand, the more energetic of the two should sometimes come to the aid of the other's will, making up for what it lacks by adroitly and educatively playing the role of a lever. Also, every strong personality has its weak points. It can be frequently noticed in some homes where the husband manifests a vitality and spirit of enterprise which makes the wife appear apathetic, that this same woman becomes the rock in matters of faith and devotion and Christian morals, and the husband is but the moving sand. This example should alert us to the danger of one of the parties abdicating before the commanding attitude of the other. For in the hour when the stronger of the two weakens, how shall the other come to his rescue and become his guide if her personality has meanwhile dissolved? Union of intelligences. Here again it is not a question of imitation but of completing each other. Masculine and feminine intelligences differ by their structures as they do by their methods of thought. They are nevertheless called to enrich each other that their vision and comprehension of the world be more adequate. Neither man nor woman has the right to become isolated in his or her speciality of thought, but, having thought first of all alone, they must share their intellectual discoveries. A warm fife of the spirit is born of such exchanges. That is why, on this plane more than on others, it is important that each cultivate his personal life, developing it with the view of a fertile common life, enriching it that each might bring to his partner something of the treasure he has found. A common intellectual activity seems an excellent means to orientate this exchange. Some homes recommend reading together, others prefer to exchange views on the same book read separately. But books or the theatre are by no means the only nourishment of the mind. The intelligence must be nourished on everything. A varied intellectual life through the communion of two minds is certainly essential if the home is to be alive and if the children are to be nourished on the same spiritual plane. To realize the last part of this common task, parents must resolve to consecrate some time to it, to choose their means with care and to make the effort of adapting their knowledge to the different degrees of intelligence growing in their home. For practical purposes it would be effective to take advantage of parties and meals for this work of adaption. In this manner the boredom of ordinary conversation is avoided and those gathered about receive food for the mind as well as food for the body. To the end of developing a common life of the spirit, artistically and intellectually, some homes perform certain material duties together.